Ah, the first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
The following podcast contains explicit language, by which we mean potty talk. It's Monday, March 26, 2018, from Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. I cannot bring you all of the important, very important coverage of the Stormy Daniels affair, a fair day storm. Was the president spanked by a Forbes magazine? If that were to happen today, now that Forbes has gone mostly digital, would you have used a laptop or a tablet? These are the questions I cannot even ask. But on this day, the White House would only answer this way when asked about the affair. Here's spokesman Raj Shah from the podium.
With respect to that interview, I will say the president strongly, clearly, and has consistently denied these underlying claims. And the only person who's been inconsistent is the one making the claims.
So you heard what he said there, and that's about as far as it went. But this is how news organizations described that response. Time, White House says President Trump doesn't believe Stormy Daniels' account of affair. The Hill, White House, : Stormy Daniels' claims of affair with Trump are not accurate. And CNN says the White House says President Trump continues to deny that he had an affair with Stormy Daniels. You know what? I agree with the White House. He did not have an affair. An affair? It was at best bonkery. And from Stormy's side of the things, not the best bonkery. Perhaps the White House simply would not want to respond to allegations of affair by using that word. Because, you know, affair to me invokes the heart, the soul, weak emotions, anathema to a president who prizes strength. Perhaps if this question were flatly asked, just put out there, did the president make the beast with two backs with Ms. Daniels, we'd get a different answer. Perhaps just a simple inquiry. Has the leader of the free world, on at least one occasion, made Congress with Ms. Clifford? Perhaps this will all be explained when Sarah Huckabee Sanders goes to the podium and says, the president of the United States does not screw or bonk or boink, as some press accounts would have you believe. What the president does is he makes love. And when love is made, believe me, you will know about it. On the show today, the stupidest things that were said this Sunday, and there's a lot of stupid to go around, just a day ago, but in a way, a lifetime. But first, we're going to deal with some art, artfully, I hope, here on The Gist, of the man called, because he was indeed, Hitler's art dealer. The Defender is a beautiful car, but beauty is, of course, sometimes only skin deep. Not with the Defender. Let's talk about the interior. It's robust, built with integrity. Yes, it's designed iconically, the exterior. That's what compelled me. My neighbor Jay says, Mike, you see what's on the block? It's a Defender. And I look down the block, and indeed there is. And me and Jay the neighbor and Michelle, we gather around the Defender. We peer in the window. I have to say, I don't want to make this too tawdry, but we lust, or perhaps we gvel. To drive the Defender is to explore with greater confidence. We looked at the cargo capacity, more room for the gear. There's really a wide range of adventures. The Defender family features the two-door Defender 90, the Defender 110, and the Defender 130, which seats up to 8. Push what's possible with a vehicle made to go further. The Defender 110. Learn more at LandRoverUSA.com/Defender. So here on The Gist, we rarely cover art, though everything we cover, we do artfully. But we have been, over the years, kind of tracking this one trove of art, which is the art that was essentially looted from Jews by Hitler. And Hitler's art curator was a man named Hildebrand Gurlitt. His son, Cornelius Gurlitt, inherited, as much as one can inherit stolen art, over 1,000 works. And in an unrelated tax case, German officials stumbled across these works. This was 5-6 years ago. And what's been happening since then is they've been figuring out what to do with the works. Well, they recently closed the first major exhibition of the works in Bonn, Germany. A new exhibition of the works will be opening in Berlin, Germany. And covering all this for us and talking about it over the years is Mary Lane, who's the former chief European art reporter for the Wall Street Journal, whose forthcoming book is called Hitler's Last Hostages, about these artworks. Hello, Mary. How are you?
Hello, I'm well. Thank you for having me, Mike.
So you went to the show in Bonn and the show in Bern?
I did. I went to both shows to see the artworks themselves finally after devoting so much of my life to this, but also to see, you know, how the museums kind of framed them and spun the cases, and then also how, you know, the ordinary people who went to the exhibitions thought of them.
Right. So the museum in Bern seems like a weird decision to have some Swiss museum exhibit them, except that was the museum that the Gurlitt family chose to give these works to, again, insofar as it was their choice to give these stolen works.
Yes. So that's a really interesting thing. So just quickly to recap for our listeners who haven't been following this case the whole time, these works were taken from Cornelius Gurlitt, the son of Hitler's art dealer, Hildebrand. They were taken from him by the government in February 2012, and then it came public in November 2013, which is when I started covering it, that the German government had taken all of these works and not told anybody about them. Obviously, Cornelius, the son, was very angry about this. He was in his 80s, his health was ailing, and he was, in many cases, rightfully annoyed that these works had been taken from him without due process, so he hadn't been charged with any crimes. And he decided, he knew he was going to die from a heart condition, and he decided, much to people's surprise, that that he was going to bequeath the works to somebody. And his first priority was, it's definitely not going to be in Germany. So he had no grandchildren, no nieces, nephews, no children. And so he had done a lot of his shady gray market dealings with an auction house in Bern, Switzerland. And the owner of that auction house was very close to the Kunstmuseum Bern, so the art museum in Bern. And that is how he decided, in a very surprise move, to bequeath all of his works to this very small museum. You know, people hear about Bern being the capital of Switzerland, but because Switzerland's a confederacy, it's really just a super tiny town.
Yeah, the biggest in that particular canton. So just give me a sense of the exhibit. How many works? How were they displayed? What context was given to them?
The one in Bern focused on the works that Hitler deemed degenerate art. So the majority of artists that Hitler considered degenerate were actually not Jewish, but they were artists that Jews favored. And they portrayed such scandalous things as women having sexuality or black people being humans, somebody not having a perfect body, or, for example, portraying Mary, the Virgin, in a state of discomfort after Jesus was born.
Yeah.
When we think about this degenerate art, a lot of it is like, you look at it and you're like, wow, that is very sexually explicit. But a lot of it was just more innocuous works, you know, like, yeah, like a black mother cradling her child. Like, God forbid black people have maternal instincts.
Right. And just going beyond that, it does seem to me that beyond all the horrors of the Nazi regime, just in terms of art, if you're only going to allow the idealized presentation of the human form, you're not going to get very interesting art. Then again, Hitler wasn't a very interesting artist.
That's one of the things that's really fascinating about this is Gurlitt justified what he was doing by saying, I'm going to rescue a lot of these works that Hitler hates. So that is what is on display in Bern and as people can see in this Berlin show. But after the war, he didn't help anybody get these works back. So people came to him and said, you know, these works were stolen from us. Do you have any idea where they are? And he was like, no. That's really fascinating about the Bern. Hmm. And the Bonn exhibit is more works that Hitler would have actually approved of, and that Gurlitt, for various reasons, ended up keeping for his collection as opposed to selling to the Master Fuhrer Museum that Hitler was planning.
So would a museum goer know about the provenance of this art?
Well, people who go to these exhibitions, I mean, it's quite fascinating because, first of all, provenance research is, to be fair, insanely difficult. The Gurlitt case, for example, they purposely burned a lot of their records. And that is a testament to their complicity with Hitler, because if you can say, I have a legally acquired a work from a prestigious family, that ups the value of the work. The only case in which that wouldn't up the value of the work is if you stole it from the family. So people going to these exhibitions will get a really good idea of the lengths to which Gurlitt went to save the artwork, but to destroy documents proving where he got them. Not only the exhibitions, but a lot of the international press, and particularly German press, didn't cover the fact that if you look very closely at the captions for the exhibition, each work gives as much of the provenance as we know so far next to it, which is wonderful. But several of them say that they come from a private collection in southern Germany. And that is a gross euphemism for Hildebrand Gurlitt's daughter and her family. And when I asked, when I said to the museum, people coming to this exhibition and looking on the wall, they're going to see works, and you've euphemistically described them as from a private collection, but we know they're still from this family. Can you compel the family to give back stolen works? You know, it's 2018. The museum said no.
So you just made a reference to if museum goers, if someone was going to the museum, saw that, they wouldn't know. Well, you actually, this isn't a hypothetical. You talked to many of the people who went to the museum. So what was their impression either of the art or how the art came to even be seen?
There was a lot of curiosity among people from China and Japan and Korea about this idea of how much of the modern art world has been shaped by these works being bought and sold in the 1940s and 50s and going abroad. When we think about the Japanese art market, for example, that came in the 1980s with the economic boom, many Japanese people, for example, were very curious about the fact that, you know, what Gurlitt did had such a profound effect on growing the Japanese art market. So in that sense, you've got this really horrible act that creates an unintentional diversification of the art market in terms of the cultural outreach it has. I mean, I talked to one really fascinating West German couple who were clearly very wealthy and in their 70s and spoke fluent English and fluent, you know, German and were very cultured. And it was fascinating because I was like, how is this? I would never have tied this into something like, you know, the political climate of 2018. But this couple, they said, you know, we're poking fingers at America for Trump, or we're poking fingers at Brexit. But maybe we need to think about, you know, what do we need to improve on here in Germany in terms of righting the wrongs of our past? And maybe we're being a bit lazy about doing that as we're so concerned with the politics of other countries.
So these were people who went to the museum who essentially found fault in the way that German authorities, be them museum officials or maybe even actual elected officials, because there is that component of it, were contextualizing the art. Why does anyone who has the ability to do anything about it, why are they either dragging their feet or just saying to you, we have no plans to give it more attention, give it more context, you know, not speak in obfuscatory terms about where these works came from?
And you have to be very careful here. There's a very German mindset of the rule of law. Doing this is legal, therefore it doesn't matter whether it's moral. Gurlitt pointed out openly, you know, the son Gurlitt, well, the father Gurlitt pointed out when he was doing it, in the 1930s, he wrote in his journals, he was like, well, like, I would have had qualms doing this in the 20s, but now they're, you know, Parliament has passed a law saying I can take works of art confiscated from these people, and so it's legal, so I don't see the problem. And then you see that happening, you know, with his son in 2013, you know, his son openly said to the media, to us, he said, well, look, like, under German law, if these Jewish families wanted their stolen art back, they had to come to me by 1970, and they didn't, so it's legally mine. Who cares if it's moral? It's legal. And I think that's sort of where that the older couple that I spoke to in West Germany, you know, where they're saying that right now a lot of countries, America and Britain and Germany, are struggling with this idea of, okay, there's a difference between what's legal and what's moral. And there's a difference between, you know, at what point does not protesting become complicity with immorality?
If there was a government advocating, not a person, but a government, maybe it would be different. I mean, earlier this month, right, France agreed to return plundered artifacts to Benin. There is these are thousands of year old or hundreds of year old artifacts. No one knows the person, if there ever was even that concept of a person owning the artifacts. You know, France returned to Egypt some 3,000-year-old statuettes last year. So it seems like the trend in the art world is to at least seriously consider this, but not the trend with these specific arts in this specific case.
One of the sad things about this, and one of the things I hoped wouldn't turn out to be true, but was true from looking at this case, is that there are so many works in the show that are breathtakingly beautiful, and many of them were not looted. They weren't looted, but he wouldn't have had the money to buy the works if he hadn't been working for Hitler.
Yeah.
So there's that aspect where the museums will say, okay, well, this wasn't a looted work of art. And I'm like, okay, like, if you're, you know, some massive cocaine dealer and you buy like a gold desk with money from cocaine, like, yes, you didn't steal the desk, but you wouldn't have had the money to buy the golden desk if it weren't for your dealing cocaine. So I think there's that aspect. But one of the things that I just find really sad is that they did such a thorough job of laying out the credible aspects of this. So showing the works that were not looted, but then they often fudged the captions about works that clearly either were taken or currently belong to this family, and there's nothing they can do about it.
So finally, where do these works go next?
So these works, so that's going to be about 250 works from Bonn and 168 works from Bern out of a total of 1,300. Many of them will be coming to Berlin at the end of the year and through early next year. And these are just so many amazing works by Georges Cloche, Monet, Manet, Rodin. There's some gorgeous Rodin statues, really just some top museum quality items that have been lost for 70 years. So they'll be showing there, and then they won't be going out of the country, obviously, because Germany is scared that they will be sued if they go out of the country because so many of these works might have been stolen. So after that, they are all the property of this tiny little museum in Bern, Switzerland, which is roughly the size of Mesquite, Texas.
Mary Lane, former chief European art reporter for the Wall Street Journal, and her forthcoming book is named Hitler's Last Hostages. Thank you, Mary.
Thank you so much for having me, Mike.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
And now the spiel. I cannot fully summarize to you everything that goes on during the Sunday shows. The shows, we know the president gets his staffing ideas about the generals from the shows. So I try to watch all the shows. Okay, that's a lie. I don't try at all. No, I couldn't. I listen to them on double speed. And sometimes, almost all the time, I get through the three that are in the broadcast networks. And then I try to hit the State of the Union on CNN and Fox, the Fox News Sunday, which is Fox News on Sunday. So I did listen, and I want to touch on some highlights, lowlights, really. There was the occasional infelicitous phrase. This was Senator Joni Ernst from Iowa on Face the Nation.
Well, I support allowing those transgenders that can serve. I believe they should serve. But I've asked transgenders myself, you know, if you are willing to lay down your life beside mine, I would welcome you into our military. But again, there are standards that have to be met. But if there are transgenders that meet those qualifications, certainly I would gladly have them serving in our United States military.
And I, as a heterosex, fully support those transgenders, and unless you are a disabled or possibly a blind, then you as a transgender can apply to be an Army American. Just a weird way to say it, I say. And then, speaking of the weird, Rick Santorum, former Republican senator from Pennsylvania, he was on CNN's State of the Union, giving some life advice to the children.
Is this really all about politics, or is it all about keeping our schools safe, because it is about keeping our schools safe, then we have to have much broader discussion than the discussion that's going on right now. How about kids, instead of looking to someone else to solve their problem, do something about maybe taking CPR classes or trying to deal with situations that where there is a violent shooter,
but
that you
can
actually
respond to. How are they looking at other people?
I
would ask you, they took action.
Yeah, they took action to ask someone to pass a law.
They took action to ask someone to pass a law. They did that because we live in a democracy, and asking someone to pass a law is what a non-elected official, also known as a citizen, should do. Do I need to explain that laws affect actions and children can't pass them without the adults? Maybe Rick Santorum is onto something, or on something that I'm not. And then there was this really, really odd one. This is Chris Ruddy, the guy who runs Newsmax. He's what's called the Trump whisperer, as if whispering would really get to Donald Trump. So Chris Ruddy constantly being asked to explain Trump, to be a mouthpiece, and he was on ABC's This Week.
And you know what? At the end of the day, the poll numbers for the president are up. Gallup has him at a record 40%, the Rasmussen at 48% approval.
A record 40%! A record! What a record! How is that a record? Let's go back. A week after being inaugurated, Gallup polled, and it showed that 45% of Americans approved of Trump. Americans are a hopeful lot, and he has hit 40% this calendar year. Actually, the 40%, that was 2 weeks ago. The latest Gallup poll shows that he's at 39%. So what is the record? I'm trying to figure out what's the record about that 40%. And then Jonathan Bernstein of Bloomberg, writing in an unrelated matter, pointed it out to me. It's the worst of any polling era president this many days into his first term. After Trump, the lowest, 431 days into office, are Harry Truman at 45%, Gerald Ford at 45.5%, Ronald Reagan at 46%, Barack Obama 48%, Jimmy Carter 50%. Trump has been in last place, and usually by an even larger margin, for almost his entire term. But then the most incredible thing happened. Again, it was Chris Ruddy, and he was asked about all the staff shakeups, and here's what he said.
The president told me he's perplexed by all of these reports. There's chaos at the White House or mass staff changes. He told me that he thinks the White House is operating like a smooth machine, his words.
Now, look, I don't doubt for a second that these were Trump's exact words. I trust Ruddy as a reporter. We know that because Trump has said as much.
This administration is running like a fine-tuned machine.
What's incredible here is that there really is no chaos as Trump sees it. The normal explanation is that he thrives in chaos or he's used to chaos. I don't know. I don't think that that's the important thing to consider in this situation. It's true. He thrives in chaos, which pretty much means he's a scattered guy. So he likes putting other people on the wrong foot. So maybe they're degraded to the mental state that he's in. Fine. But here's what I think is really going on. The job that he is doing is different from the job the media is expecting him to do or grading him on. And it's an incredible thing, the continued disconnect between the man and the job he's expecting to do, the job that many of us are still acting as if he's doing. The media, citizens, right-thinking Americans want to hold the president accountable, but it's impossible to hold a person accountable when that person is fundamentally not doing the job you're trying to hold him accountable to. What we want is for Donald Trump to run the country, or to be more specific, to direct the actions of the executive branch and all the agencies thereof. Trump has no interest in this. Trump is simply putting on a show. Okay, you're saying, we've heard this one before. It's not that it's untrue, but it's a little cliched at this point. No, I'm making a slightly different point. It's this, that every man to possess the office of the president has had a deep and abiding opinion about the policy directions of the country. Their methods differed, their strategies differed, but each one took the job primarily to achieve policy outcomes. Trump isn't just the first person who never served in public office or in the military to become president. He is the first person not to care about policy outcomes to become president. And this means he's not doing the job we think he's doing. All he wants to do is continue being a showman. We call him a businessman, but his business is that of branding Trump on buildings or steaks or vodka or universities. He's a brander. What is a brand except an extension of the show to a physical property? who's the head of HUD or the Department of Education or what's going on in Puerto Rico. It doesn't matter. It simply does not matter. He doesn't want to do it right. He doesn't want to do it wrong. It doesn't matter. He could soon fire the well-regarded head of Veterans Affairs, David Shulkin. Do you think before 2 weeks ago he ever thought of David Shulkin? The name David Shulkin did not cross President Trump's mind for months at a time, I can assure you. Before Ben Carson and the Hutch, when was the last time he stopped for 2 seconds and said, HUD, I wonder how HUD's going? Other presidents have been hands-off, have been non-interventionists. That was their policy. Hoover, famously, he personally knew the crash was coming. He sold his stocks, but he still wouldn't intervene on behalf of the government because he didn't think that was his role. It was a foolish choice, but he was trying to achieve a policy outcome. Trump is in the job for personal enrichment and, sure, some version of ego gratification, but he is putting on a show. That's all he was doing. And that's how we have to evaluate him. We can't say he's causing chaos. Chaos is besides the point to what his goal is, which is to put on a show. Do we say the show Breaking Bad was chaotic because it had all these plot elements, because Walter White was always getting himself into scrapes? No, that's what made the show so compelling. Do we think of Law and Order as out of control because every episode someone was murdered? No, that's what the show's about. He ran a show on TV. It was called The Apprentice. It was about pitting people against each other. He's just continuing to put on this show. Lots of politicians get charged with being a showman. It usually means something like they have more style than substance, or you're putting on a show of addressing an issue when you're not really addressing an issue. You know, you're trying for a photo op, or you're putting on a show over here to do the real business, your real nefarious business that you don't want us to pay attention to over there. That's not Trump. Trump simply has no policy aims. He's there to create conflict and drama, and he believes that he'll come out on top afterwards. The finely tuned machine that he speaks of is the flat screen TV and your iPhone, and they're working just fine for him. That's it for today's show. The Gist was produced by Pierre Bien-Aimé. He prefers making bacon with care and tenderness, because grease fires can really splash on you and hurt. Daniel Schrader also produced today's show. He's given to doing the wild thing with the lesser-known works of Tone Loke playing on the hi-fi. Mary Wilson, just senior producer, knows on an intellectual level there needs to be terms to describe such acts, but when she hears such vulgarities as pestering the accountant or taking turns on an industrial loom, she just chafes. Steve Lickteig is executive producer of Slate Podcasts. Now, as a canoe owner, this guy knows that sometimes your vessel loses its luster and could, in fact, do for a fresh coat of shellac. But you can't advertise that on Craigslist. The Gist. I do not know about Stormy Daniels' legal case, but I would not be surprised if the next revelations come from within the family quarters of the White House. What I'm saying is, if SCOTUS don't notice, FLOTUS could alert us about POTUS coitus. Oompa-roo-da-peru-doo-peru, and thanks for listening.